Watchman's Teaching Letter, Volume 1. Just who is this Patriarch Judah? Watchman's Teaching Letter, Number 18, October 1999. From the 1999 Watchman's Teaching Letters by Clifton Emhiser. Read by Dan Adams. This is the 18th of a series of teaching letters. With the last lesson, I concluded the study appertaining to Emperor Constantine the Great. I have been dissecting, examining, and analyzing his story since the end of Watchman's Teaching Letter number 15. My method of approaching a subject is to cut it up into many small pieces and examine it from every possible angle. Starting with lesson number 13, I began a continuing study on the history of the British Celtic Church, inaugurated by Joseph of Arimathea, being ordained by Philip the Apostle to do so. All 17 lessons so far, since lesson 1, have concerned themselves with the topic of Judah in one way or another. Because the British are the Zara branch of Judah, this lesson is a continuation of the same subject matter. Emperor Constantine died in 337 AD, and the next important historical element which detrimentally affected the history of the British Celtic Church was the invasion of Britain by the various tribes of Saxons, along with the Jutes, J-U-T-E-S. I would urge you to make copies of these lessons on the British Church and give them to your uninformed friends, especially of Irish or Scottish descent. This is the history of their ancestors and of their church. The Irish and the Scots are of the same stock, except they arrived in Britain at different times. The ancestors of the Irish arrived about 1600 BC, and the Scots arrived 501 AD via Scythia and Spain. The emblem for both is the red hand. The only reason the Irish and Scots are mostly Roman Catholic today is because King Henry II sold them out to Pope Adrian at the Synod of Cashel. If the Roman Catholic, Irish, and Scots, and Protestant for that matter, ever learn their true history, that the Celtic Church of Britain was the first true church outside of the one at Jerusalem, and never the Roman Catholic Church, hell would seem like a mild place to be in comparison to their presence. Now continuing the topic. Just who is this Patriarch Judah? Part 18. King Henry II sells out the Celtic Church to Rome. To start this lesson, I am going to quote from the book The Story of the Irish Race by Seamus McManus. Seamus being the Gaelic or Celtic for James. Sounds good in any of our languages. How about James McManus? The Irish Seamus McManus. Assisted by several Irish scholars, pages 327 to 328. Then he, King Henry II, ruled between 1154 and 1189, won Rome too. He had a synod of the Irish ecclesiastics, all but the primate, Galasius, and the other northerns, called at Cashel, where, following the example of their chiefs, the bishops acknowledged Henry as Lord Supreme in Ireland. At this synod, they passed decrees for the bettering of church discipline, which, being sent to Rome, confirmed the fact that Henry was carrying out his undertaking and reforming morals in the land. And evoked from Alexander III, the Pope from 1159 to 1181, the letter confirmatory of Adrian's, an English Pope's, bull. Adrian IV was Pope from 1154 to 1159. At Easter, Henry had to return in haste to England, carrying with him the undisputed lordship of Leinster, Meath, and the cities of Dublin, Wexford, and Waterford. Meath he gave in trust to de Lacy, who had the governorship of Dublin also. The city of Dublin was given to the occupation of the merchants and people of Bristol. Strongbow was left in possession of Leinster. The strange mesmerism which the presence of Henry seemed to have wrought on the Irish princes was dissipated on his going. They awoke to the rude reality that they had welcomed an invader and meekly accepted him. From the various quarters they began to rise up against the enemy, harass him, and endeavor to drive him out. now more familiar with and therefore less daunted by Norman discipline and equipment, the Irish princes set strategy against skill and discovered that the Normans were not omnipotent. O'Brien of Thomond inflicted a big defeat upon them at Thurles, not the only big defeat that he was to give them. Strongbow the Mighty was beaten back in the south and bottled up in Waterford, in imminent danger of capture, and only the fact that the redoubtable Le Gros hurried back from Wales to release him, or he would have been overthrown. Roderick O'Connor, with the help of O'Neill, O'Melaghlin, O'Carroll, MacDunleavy of Ulaid, and an army of 20,000 overran Meath and set out for Dublin, which he might easily have captured, but for his vacillation, indecision. He, Roderick O'Connor, soon after thought it to be to his advantage to make a treaty with Henry. He sent to England for that purpose Concord, Abbot of Clonfert, Catholicus, Archbishop of Tuam, and Archbishop Lawrence O'Toole of Dublin. This treaty, known as the Treaty of Windsor, acknowledged Henry's right to the lordship of Leinster, Meath, and the other few places and cities then occupied by him. He was also acknowledged as the overlord, to whom Roderick should pay formal tribute. On the other hand, it acknowledged Roderick's right to the high kingship of 5/6 of Ireland. But such pacts had little effect either in securing peace or ensuring the rights of either party. Every Norman chief warred on his own account, for the purpose of extending his power and possessions, and of course every Irish chief and prince, when opportunity offered, warred against the invader. End quote. The Synod of Cashel, with King Henry II handing over the British Celtic Church to Pope Adrian, happened in 1172 A.D., so we are getting ahead of our story. The story that we want to bring forward in this lesson is the Saxon invasions of Britain. By the year 411 A.D., the Roman Empire was in such a massive decline it was necessary for her to recall her troops from Britain. If you will remember, in Lesson 16, it was mentioned how Constantius Chlorus and his son Constantine, who later became Constantine the Great, initially went to Britain to fight the Picts, P-I-C-T-S. After the Romans withdrew their troops from Britain in 411, the Britons were still having problems with the Picts. After 106 years, the Picts were still giving the Britons headaches. The Britons then invited a few Saxons in to help control the unruly Picts, whereupon the Saxons kept coming in waves for the next 200 years. This is where we will pick up our story, and I will quote from The Legacy of Arthur's Chester by Robert B. Stoker, starting with page 21. British invite the Saxons, Jutes, to help fight the Picts. Let us now move to the invasion of the Saxons, and Archbishop Ten, Guitelin, one of 13 named archbishops of Coeur Lion. When the Saxon came in A.D. 449, they were invited by Fortecairn, king of the Britons, as mercenaries, and were given the Isle of Thanet, what once was an island, some 600 meters offshore from the rest of Kent in southeastern England. After beating the Scots, who had penetrated a long way into England at Stamford, the Saxons were rewarded by Fortegern with the land in Lincolnshire, and further Saxons landed. As the British were suspicious of Fortegern's friendship with the Saxons, Hengist, known to us through the venerable Bede's 8th-century history, who had only 3 keels, quote-unquote, of his troops, used this suspicion to persuade the king to allow him to bring over more, quote-unquote, trusty Saxons for his protection. Now Hengist had a beautiful daughter called Rowena, who after dancing before Fortegern, who had a grown-up son, and drinking his health, Yever Canig Coenic Vas Hael, Lord King, your health, so inflamed the king, probably excited the king, that not only did he divorce his wife, but gave Hengist Kent as a marriage gift, without consulting the nobles or people. Vortigern, known to us mostly through the 6th century historian Gildas Sapiens, Gildas the Wise, from 500 to 570. Vortigern, it is said here, upon seeing Hengist's daughter Rowena dance before him, wanted her so much that he was willing to divorce his wife and give Hengist the territory that became the Kingdom of Kent for the purpose. Hengist persuaded Vortigern to allow him to bring more Saxons over to protect him from his complaining subjects, who began to turn their eyes toward Ambrosius, young son of the later Constantine, that Constantine who was beheaded by the Emperor Honorius Rapine, who was sheltering at the home of his kinsman Aldroan of Brittany. Hengist then started to ravage the country, especially the churches, which being of wood have disappeared without a trace. Note, Ambrosius Aurelianus, 5th century, no more precise than that, Welsh, Emrys Vledig, called Aurelius Ambrosius in the Histori Regium Britanniae and elsewhere, was a war leader of the Romano-British who won an important battle against the Anglo-Saxons in the 5th century, according to Gildas. He also appeared independently in the legends of the Britons, beginning with the 9th century Historia Britonum. This is an excellent quote and should start to give you a good picture in your mind as to the situation which was happening during this period of time in Britain. On pages 23 and 4 of the same book, we get the following. These Saxons attacked the Scots and established themselves in Northumbria under Octa and Ebisa, or Ebusa, of whom we shall read later. Vortigern's son then surprised him, and taking over the kingdom, made war on the Saxons, but in A.D. 457 was badly defeated at Crayford, Kent, and sought refuge in London. This would account for Guitelin, the Archbishop of London, becoming Archbishop of Chester, and Chester being the capital of Ambrosius, who had deposed Vortigern. When Hengist by treachery killed 300 or more British nobles at Stonehenge in A.D. 473 and took Vortigern prisoner, he received Essex, Middlesex, London, and Winchester, and some say York and Lincoln as well, as ransom. End quote. Now that we have laid an understandable foundation for this interesting, intriguing story of the invasions of Britain by the Saxons, which included the Angles and Jutes, we can single out pieces of the story from various sources to make it even more crystal clear. The next authoritative source I would like to quote, which presents a comprehensive portrayal of this period, is from The Origin and Early History of Christianity in Britain by Andrew Gray, D.D., pages 55 through 60. The Saxon invasion, no longer protected by the powerful countenance of the Roman emperors, she, Britain, was now grievously oppressed by the frequent incursions of those predatory tribes who occupied the northern frontier of Britain, the Picts, as the Caledonians were then called, and the Scots, a tribe who had migrated from Ireland via Scythia and Spain. In their distress, the people of South Britain sent an appeal to Rome for help, inscribed "The Groans of the Britons." But there were northern barbarians at the time threatening Rome itself. The great fabric of the empire was tottering to its foundation, and Rome, feeling obliged to concentrate around the capital the scattered forces of the empire, had withdrawn her legions from Britain in A.D. 410. Attila, surnamed the Scourge of God, with his conquering hordes had crossed the Alps and was advancing on Rome, so the petition from Britain was unheeded. In this extremity of desertion of the Romans, on the one hand, and suffering on the other from the Picts, the Britons persuaded Vortigern, Prince of Damnonium, South Britain, to send deputies to the Saxons requesting their assistance. This was an evil hour for the Britons, for of all the German tribes, the Saxons were the most warlike and savage. Gildas speaks of the stupidity and infatuation under which the Britons acted in calling to their help a nation whom they dreaded more than death. The Saxons readily responded to the request, and under Hengist and Horsa, their leaders, They landed in Britain A.D. 449 and made short work with the Picts and Scots. This first success speedily brought over more of their adventurous countrymen, who became so charmed with the fertility of the soil and the mildness of the climate that they soon assumed the attitude of conquerors, and joining the Picts and Scots against the Britons by force of arms, they maintained their possession of the country. For a time, Britain, unaided and alone, successfully withstood them. Indeed, under Ambrosius Aurelianus in A.D. 489, they seem to have won an important battle at Bannisdown. Ambrosius is said to have employed the respite, temporary delay thus afforded, in rebuilding some of the churches which had been destroyed in the war, and in providing for better settlement of religious affairs. But eventually, victory crowned the efforts of the enemy, Saxons, Angles, and Jutes, and never was a victory more complete or more cruelly misused. Probably of all the hordes that dismembered the Roman Empire, the Saxons were the most barbarous. The greatest virtue with them was courage, and the greatest vice was cowardice. And so, Britain from the east to west became involved in rapine and slaughter. Her cruel masters turned their ruthless hands against everything and person that had a religious character, destroyed every church they could reach, and slew the Christians at the very altars. The bishops and clergy were hunted down like wild beasts, and they either miserably perished or else sought refuge in expatriation, exile. And, as if this condition of things was not already bad enough for the despised and downtrodden faith, Fortigern, the prince king, already referred to, married the daughter of Hengist, thus forming a royal alliance with Saxon paganism. The Jutes and the Angles rushed to the quarry, and with murderous rapidity carried fire and sword to every part of Britain proper. The Britons long maintained the unequal combat, but after a struggle of 150 years, were compelled to receive the yoke of their heartless pagan conquerors. The German conquest of Britain was a complete dispossession or slaughter of the conquered people. Wherever the conqueror went, the vengeance he took on the Britons was terrible. Whole villages and towns were consigned to the flames, and a promiscuous slaughter of the inhabitants ensued. Everything Celtic was as effectively wiped out of the land as everything Roman was wiped out of Africa by the Saracen conquerors of Carthage. Britain ceased to be Britain and became England. The religion, the laws, the language were all changed. Bede says that all public and private buildings were destroyed. The blood of the priest was poured out on the altars. The prelates and people were destroyed together by fire and sword, and no man dared to give them burial. This was the barbarous 5th century, when for most people life was nasty, brutish, and short. This should give you some idea what brother will do against brother, and kinsman against kinsman in the name of religion. By this time in history, evidently, all knowledge of kinsmanship had been lost. Writers on this subject debate the extent of the paganism of the Saxons, but it is evident that if the Saxon and British beliefs were somewhat similar, all these wars could have been avoided. Later, the Saxons, Angles, and Jutes would be converted in one way or another back to belief in our Redeemer. This is another very involved story in itself, and must be dealt with in its proper place and order. To further document this story of the invasion of the Saxons, I will quote from Celt Druid and Chaldee by Isabel Hill Elder, pages 118 to 120. Celts pushed westward. The Anglo-Saxon invasion, which resulted in the most important and complete of all the tribal settlements in Britain, took place between AD 446 and 501. In these incursions, the Jutes and Angles were the first to arrive, and the Angles, being numerically the strongest constituent, gave their name in this country to the entire group, which on the continent were known as Saxons. The Anglo-Saxon invasion had the effect of gradually pushing the Celts to the west of England and southwest Scotland. When this occurred, and the archbishops of Coeur d'Alene-en-Usk, London, and York saw all the churches in their jurisdiction lying level with the ground, they fled with all the clergy that remained after so great a destruction to the coverts of the woods in Wales and to Cornwall. From this fact it is easily discernible how it came to pass that the Culdee British Church has been associated to so great an extent with Wales and southern Scotland. As the British were being driven farther and farther to the west, naturally they moved their ministries along with them. It was similar in manner to the early Christians moving their worship services into the catacombs and the Waldenses moving their place of worship into mountain caves and secluded forested areas. I found the following information in a very unusual place, the book The Great Controversy Between Christ and Satan by Ellen G. White. She did not know of nor teach Israel identity. Pages 70 and 71. She had the following to say about Britain. The Celtic Church goes underground. In Great Britain, primitive Christianity had very early taken root. The gospel received by the Britons in the first centuries was then uncorrupted by Roman apostasy. Persecution from pagan emperors, which extended even to these far-off shores, was the only gift that the first churches of Britain received from Rome. Many of the Christians fleeing from persecution in Saxon England found refuge in Scotland. Thence the truth was carried to Ireland, and in all these countries it was received with gladness. When the Saxons invaded Britain, heathenism gained control. The conquerors disdained to be instructed by their slaves, and the Christians were forced to retreat to the mountains and the wild moors. Yet the light, hidden for a time, continued to burn in Scotland. A century later, it shone out with a brightness that extended to far distant lands. From Ireland came the pious Columba and his co-laborers, who, gathering about them the scattered believers on the lonely island of Iona, made this the center of their missionary labors. Among these evangelists was an observer of the Bible Sabbath, and thus this truth was introduced among the people. A school was established at Iona, from which missionaries went out not only to Scotland and England, but to Germany, Switzerland, and even Italy. End quote. To understand where the Angles, Saxons, and Jutes were pushing the Britons, I will quote again from The Origin and Early History of Christianity in Britain by Andrew Gray, pages 60 and 62. The British Celtic Church almost fades from view, but the whole of the western part of the country remained unconquered. Strathclyde, including the country from Clyde to the Dee, the Kingdom of Cumbria, North Wales, or Cambria, South Wales, and Devon and Cornwall, with part of Somerset and the sacred Avalon, remained purely British. This land the English called Welsh land, or land of the foreigner, Welsh being the name which the Germans applied to all nations speaking languages of Latin descent, and they found that all was lost them. In A.D. 587 they were forced by persecution to fly and join their brethren in Wales. To those parts we must now look for the primitive Church of Britain. It was shut off from, and perhaps to a considerable extent forgotten by, the larger portion of Christendom, but it now formed a closer alliance with the sister churches of Ireland and Scotland. It was conscious of no submission to any foreign church, but gazed fondly back to Jerusalem and the Holy Land rather than to Rome. It had its own liturgy, its own customs, its own peculiar, although erroneous, cycle of computing Easter. Note, if they were keeping Passover at the time of the full moon, regardless of the day of the week, as in the East, it was not erroneous. It was orthodox in faith. It had, as we learn from Gildas, a regularly ordained episcopate. It believed its bishops to be the successors of the apostles, and its priests claimed the power to bind and loose. It is of the greatest importance that we should gather all the information possible concerning the church in Wales, and get as definite an idea of it as we can. There are, unfortunately, those who erroneously suppose that the link between the early British Church and the Church of England of the present day was broken by the Saxon invasion, and that the present Church of England arose in the time of Augustine, deriving its origin from Rome through him, and not, as we are bound to maintain, from the apostles and Jerusalem in unbroken continuous descent through the British or Celtic Church. The Saxon invasion had destroyed civilization and Christianity in the larger part of England proper, but a remnant was driven westward and found its home in Wales. End quote. I have now shown you several of the pro-identity sources for this information concerning the Saxon invasions of Britain, which many will ridicule. Many historians and older encyclopedias relegate this time period to romance and the mythical, as though it were never historical fact. Especially my 1894 edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica is guilty of this. Usually the older the book, generally the better its content, but not in this case. I am finding in my research on these things different writers citing archaeologists, finding from time to time proof of the facts written by these old antiquarians. Evidently, enough evidence has been brought forward so that more modern reviewers are a little hesitant to consign this very important history, as they put it, to quote-unquote romance. For instance, when one considers the personage of Fortigern, he is getting very close in time and place to the so-called legendary personage of King Arthur. If you want to research the subject of the Saxon invasions from some of your own encyclopedias and history books, use these keywords in the indexes. Fortigern, which is spelt with a V, V-O-R-T-I-G-E-R-N, Saxon, Anglo-Saxons. I will now quote from some of my encyclopedias and history books, and, as I do, compare some of the facts as I have quoted above from pro-identity sources. First, I will quote from the World Book Encyclopedia, Volume 1, under Anglo-Saxon, page 441. Anglo-Saxon is a name given to the nation created by the union of the Germanic tribes that settled in England in the AD 400s and 500s. These tribes were the Angles, Saxons, and Jutes. In about 449, a British king named Vortigern invited the Germanic tribes to come to England to help him drive back the invading Picts and Scots. But the allies quarreled, and soon these tribes began to drive out the Britons. By the end of the 500s, the Angles, Saxons, and Jutes occupied nearly all of England to the borders of Wales and Scotland. The word England was taken from Old English words Engla and land, which mean land of the Angles. There were 7 major Anglo-Saxon kingdoms: Northumbria, Mercia, East Anglia, Essex, Sussex, Kent, and Wessex. These were known as the Heptarchy, ruled by 7 kings. The Anglo-Saxons left their mark on the English language in its grammar and in thousands of words, including perhaps half the words we usually use today. These words may be traced to the dialect that was developed in northern England. The southern dialect became the literary language of Anglo-Saxon England and was used chiefly in writing verse. Again, from the World Book Encyclopedia, Volume 17, under Saxon, page 142, we read this. Saxon is a member of a Germanic tribe that invaded the island of Britain about 1500 years ago. The Angles, another Germanic tribe, invaded Britain about the same time. The two tribal groups mixed and established the Anglo-Saxon kingdom, which lasted until the Norman conquest of 1066. The ancient geographer Ptolemy first mentioned the Saxons in a book he wrote during the AD 100s, 2nd century. According to Ptolemy, the Saxons lived in an area in southern Denmark called Saxony, now Schleswig, in Germany. They were a warlike people who invaded Roman territory in the late 300s, 4th century, during the reigns of emperors Julian and Valentinian. By the 500s, the Saxons had settled along the coast of Gaul, now France, between the Elbe and Loire rivers. The Saxons invaded Britain in the mid-400s, conquered the Celts who lived there, and settled in the southern and western parts of the island. End quote. You will notice the facts presented in these articles by the World Book Encyclopedia supports, assists, upholds, and strengthens the information and actuality of these other writers quoted before above. For further confirmation from a history book, actually a volume of a set of several books, I will quote from The Story of Civilization, Part 4, The Age of Faith by Will Durant, pages 80 and 81. But in the 4th and 5th century, security was threatened on every front, on the north by the Picts of Caledonia, on the east and south by Norse and Saxon raiders, on the west by the unsubdued Celts of Wales and the adventurous Gaels and Scots of Ireland. In 364 to 367, Scot and Saxon coastal raids increased alarmingly. British and Gaelic troops repelled them, but Stilicho had to repeat the process a generation later. In 381, Maximus, in 407, the usurper Constantine, a later Constantine, took from Britain, for their personal purposes, legions for home defense, Roman, and few of these men returned. Invaders began to pour over the frontiers. Britain appealed to Stilicho for help, 400 AD, but he was fully occupied in driving Goths and Huns from Italy and Gaul. When a further appeal was made to the Emperor Honorius, he answered that the British must help themselves as best they could. In the year 409, says Bede, the Romans ceased to rule in Britain. Faced with a large-scale invasion of Picts, the British leader Vortigern invited some North German tribes to come to his help. Saxons came from the region of the Elbe, Angles from Schleswig, Jutes from Jutland. Tradition, perhaps legend, reports that the Jutes arrived in 449 under the command of two brothers suspiciously named Hengist and Horsa, that is, stallion and mare. Note, I don't see where these names are any more suspicious than Sitting Bull or Crazy Horse, as the Israelite tribes loved and even decorated their horses like they custom detail paint their autos today. The various Germans drove back the Picts and Scots, received tracts of land as reward, noted the military weakness of Britain, and sent the joyful word to their fellows at home. Uninvited German hordes landed on Britain's shores. They were resisted with more courage than skill. They alternately advanced and retired through a century of guerrilla war. Finally, the Teutons defeated the British at Dirham in 577 and made themselves masters of what would later be called Angleland, England. Most Britons thereafter accepted the conquest and mingled their blood with that of the conquerors, which were actually of the same stock. A hardy minority retreated into the mountains of Wales and fought on. Some others crossed the channel and gave their name to Brittany. The cities of Britain were ruined by the long contest. Transport was disrupted, industry decayed, law and order languished, art hibernated, and the incipient Christianity of the island was overwhelmed by the pagan gods and customs of Germany. Britain and its language became Teutonic. Roman law and institutions disappeared. Roman municipal organization was replaced by village communities. A Celtic element remained in English blood, physiognomy, character, literature, and art, but remarkably little in English speech, which is now a cross between German and French, end quote. I know I am repeating and going over this story again and again, but with each new quotation, more intriguing details come to light so we can understand all the circumstances surrounding this story. We have to know all of this because very important church history surrounds all of these interesting movements and counter-movements. It may not appear like it, but Yahweh was moving everything according to his plan for his people and his anointed Celtic, Chaldee, British, evangelistic gospel message to all of his Israel nations. Once you comprehend all of these historical movements, his plan becomes evident. Never once did his plan get delayed, nor ever was it premature. Now we will read this story as presented by Cyclopedia of Universal History by John Clark Ridpath, LLD, Volume 2, pages 81 through 86. The people of the English-speaking race, the story of the Anglo-Saxons can never fail to interest. The hardy and adventurous stock transplanted from the stormy shores of the Baltic to the foggy island of Britain had grown into imperishable renown, and the rough accent of the old pirates of Jutland is heard in all the harbors of the world. The native seat of the Anglo-Saxons has been already defined. From the River Scheldt to the islands of the Jutes and extending far inland lies a low and marshy country, through which the rivers, for want of fall, can scarcely make their way to the sea. The soil is a sediment, the sky a bed of dun mist and heavy clouds, pouring out the perpetual rains. Ever and anon, after a while, the storms roll in from the North Sea and the black waves plunge and roar and bellow along the coast. From the first, human life in this low and doleful region has been an everlasting broil with the ocean. It was from these dreary regions that the storm-beaten, war-hardened fathers of the English race came from in the middle of the 5th century, to plant themselves in Britain. Nor was the natural scenery of the new habitat, shrouded in fogs and drenched with rain, girdled with stormy oceans and clad in sunless forest, better calculated than their original seats to develop in our forefathers the sentiments of tenderness and refinement. By the banks of the muddy British rivers and on the margin of the somber oak woods, the mixed tribes of Angles, Saxons, Jutes, and Frisians established themselves and began to work out the severe but grand problems of English civilization. Of the personal characteristics and intellectual features of the race much has been written, but nothing better in the way of description and analysis than the essay of the eloquent Taine. Of the Anglo-Saxons he says, "Huge white bodies, cool-blooded, with fierce blue eyes, reddish flaxen hair, ravenous stomachs, filled with meat and cheese, heated by strong drinks, of a cold temperament, slow to love, homestayers, prone to brutal drunkenness. These are to this day the features which descent and climate preserve in the race, and these are what the Roman historians discovered in their former country. Behold them now in England more settled and wealthier. Do you look to find them much changed? Changed it may be, but for the worse, like the Franks, like all barbarians who pass from action to enjoyment. They are more gluttonous, carving their hogs, filling themselves with flesh, swallowing down deep draughts of mead, alcoholic beverage brewed from honey, ale, spiced wines, all the strong, coarse drinks which they can procure, and so they are cheered and stimulated. Add to this the pleasure of the fight. Not easily with such instincts can they attain to culture, to find a natural and ready culture. We must look among the sober and sprightly populations of the South." Such is a picture of the character and life of the Anglo-Saxons when they began to possess themselves of England. It was in the middle decade of the 5th century of our era that the half-civilized Celtic people of South Britain, left naked by the withdrawal of the Roman legions and hard-pressed on the north by the Picts and Scots, adopted the fatal expedient of inviting to their aid the barbarians of the Baltic. The tribes thus solicited were the Jutes, the Angles, the Saxons, and the Frisians. The first mentioned dwelt in the Cymric Chersonesus, now Jutland, or Denmark. Parts of Schleswig and Holstein were also included in their territories. In the latter country, the district known as Angeln was native seat of the Angles. To the south of these two regions, spreading from Weser to the delta of the Rhine, lay the country of the Saxons, embracing the states afterward known as Westphalia, Friesland, Holland, and part of Belgium. A glance at the map will show that these tribes occupied a position of easy approach by sea to the British Isles. Albeit in matters of war, the British Celts were no match for the rude barbarians of the north, who now descended in countless swarms upon the coast of the island, it is believed that Hengist and Horsa, the leaders of the barbarians' host, which accepted the call of the Celts, as well as a majority of their followers in the first expedition, were Jutes. With them, however, a large body of Angles from Holstein and Saxons from Friesland were joined in the invasion. So came a mixed host into England. At this time, the king of the British Celts was Vortigern. Him the Jute chieftains aided in driving back the Picts and Scots. When the island was thus freed from its peril, the Celtic king was entertained at a feast given by Hengist. Beautiful was Rowena, the daughter of the warlike host. By her was the heart of Vortigern fatally ensnared. Humbly he sought and gladly received her hand, and in proof of gratitude he gave to the Jutes the Isle of Thanet. Here the invaders found a permanent footing and would not be dismissed. Fresh bands were invited from the Baltic. The fertility of exposed Britain and the wealth of the Celtic towns excited the insatiable cupidity of the barbarians. First quarrels and then hostilities broke out between them and the Celts. The sword was drawn, Vortigern was deposed, and his son Vortimer elected in his stead. A hollow and deceptive truce was concluded, and the chief personages on both sides came together in a feast. When the drinking was at its height, Hengist called out to the Saxons, "Nimd your saxes, take your swords," whereupon each warrior drew forth his blade and cut down all who were present except Vortigern. The result of the first contest in the island was that all of Kent, the ancient Cantium, was seized by the invaders and ruled by Eric, the son and successor of Hengist. Thus was established the first Saxon kingdom in England. The western coast of England, from the Frith to Clyde to the Land's End in Cornwall, and the southern coast, from Cornwall to the borders of Hampshire, remained in possession of the Celts. A large possession of the original Celts remained in their homes and were blended with the conquering people. The Mercian Angles are said to have contributed more than any other of the northern tribes to the general subjugation of Britain. Such was the Saxon conquest of England, and such is the story of the establishment of the seven petty kingdoms known by the name of the Heptarchy. The movement of the German tribes from the north occupied a period of nearly 200 years. More than half of that time, so stubborn was the resistance of the Britons, was occupied with fierce wars between the invaders and the invaded. End quote. The British Celtic Church rebounds to life again. The Celtic Church was finally driven to the extreme west of the island because of the 200 years of Saxon invasions. The Saxons were by this time in possession of over 75% of the land. It appeared again that the light might flicker and finally go out on the church which was started by Joseph of Arimathea. But suddenly the light recovered to shine ever brighter. For this part of the story, I will quote from a secular source of history, The Story of Civilization, Part 4, The Age of Faith by Will Durant, page 532. As Germanic invasions of Gaul and Britain had driven scholars from those lands to Ireland, so now the wave returned, the debt was paid, Irish missionaries flung themselves upon the victorious pagan Angles, Saxons, Norwegians, and Danes in England, and upon the illiterate and half-barbarous Christians of Gaul and Germany, with the Bible in one hand and classic manuscripts in the other, and for a time it seemed that the Celts would win back through Christianity the lands they had lost to force. It was in the Dark Ages that the Irish spirit shone with its strongest light. The greatest of these missionaries was St. Columba. We know him well through the biography written around 679 by Adamnan, one of his successors at Iona. Columba was born at Donegal in 521 of royal stock. He was a saint who could have been a king. At school in Moville, he showed such devotion that his schoolmaster named him Columcille, Column of the Church. From the age of 25, he founded a number of churches and monasteries, of which the most famous were at Derry, Duro, and Kells. But he, Columba, was a fighter as well as a saint, a man of powerful frame and mighty voice. His hot temper drew him into many quarrels, at last into war with King Diarmuid, a battle that was fought in which, we are told, 5,000 men were killed. Columba, though victorious, fled from Ireland in 563, resolved to convert as many souls as had fallen in that engagement at Cool Drevna. He now founded on the island of Iona, off the west coast of Scotland, one of the most illustrious of medieval monasteries. Thence he and his disciples brought the gospel to the Hebrides, Scotland, and northern England. And there, after converting thousands of pagans and illuminating 300 noble books, he died in prayer at the altar in his 78th year. End quote. The Horizon History of Christianity by Roland H. Bainton, a secular source, has this to say on page 142. In 563, St. Columba, a Celtic abbot, had gone from Ireland to Scotland, where he established a monastery on the island of Iona. After converting the king, the saint and his disciples won the inhabitants of Scotland, then called the Picts, P-I-C-T-S. The Celtic Irish were ready to convert the Picts, but there was at first no disposition on the part of the Celtic Britons to convert the Anglo-Saxons. Unlike the barbarians who invaded other parts of Europe, these barbarians were brutal in their conquest of Britain. Consequently, those native Britons that survived the invasion were driven west into Wales and Cornwall. It was left to the Irish monks settled in Scotland to begin the conversion of the Anglo-Saxons of northern England, just shortly after Augustine, a Roman Catholic priest who had no connection with the Celtic Church whatever, undertook the conversion of Saxons of the South. End quote. Isabel Hill Elder, in her book Celt, Druid, and Chaldee, has this to say about St. Columba and Iona, page 113. The great St. Columba, fourth in descent from Nail of the Nine Hostages, born A.D. 522, about 50 years after the death of St. Patrick, was associated with the Chaldee Church of Iona for 32 years, where he arrived from Ireland with his 12 disciples on Pentecost Eve in the year 565. We are here given another instance of the faithfulness of the Chaldees to the first foundations in the formation of a new settlement. Many of the continental monasteries owed their foundations to Irish scholars. When Columba turned his back on Derry and the lament that is one of the loveliest ancient Irish poems, and founded the monastery at Iona, it was but the beginning of a movement which brought so many scholars to the Irish schools. But the claim of the Irish schools is not so much in the intricate treasure of their manuscripts as in the other pattern which they wove into the history of Europe. End quote. End of Watchman's Teaching Letter number 18. Thank you for listening.